The Alex Goldstein Property Show.
Stray FM.
Welcome again to the Alex Goldstein Property Show, the number one show on Stray FM. We aim to demystify the property sector and all things property related to help you make the right decision when it comes to your property experience. My social media accounts are exploding, and thank you so much to everyone who's been helping me spread the word. You're really making sure that those who need a bit of extra insight into the world of buying and selling homes are getting the vital information they need. Now, I'm sure you don't need reminding, but just in case, follow me on Twitter at #AlexOGoldstein or on Facebook and LinkedIn at Alex Goldstein Property Consultants. A truly exceptional show this month. We have property royalty Alan Waxman from Landmass in London, who's regularly in the press for creating spectacular basement conversions across London. We've also a highly regarded Harrogate architect Joel Smith from SNSA. An excellent question in the property hospital, the latest news and advice to help you with your property dreams. A huge amount to fit in as always, so we're straight on with it.
Property news with Alex Goldstein.
Stray FM.
In the property news, we're talking about the general election, the media and the property market. Now, the outcome of the general election has left many with differing opinions. Theresa May has lost the overall majority. Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party gained an extra 30 seats, taking them up to 262, while the Tories lost 13 seats, and that took them down to 313. The press and the spin doctors have seized the moment, claiming that Labour won. But hold on, unless my calculations are completely out, in my opinion, I'd say that Labour lost. They've got 51 fewer seats than the Tories, albeit fine, the Tories lost that overall majority ruling. Now, according to the media, this unprecedented result has led to many people adopting a wait-and-see approach to buying and selling their homes. Apparently, the recent political events had led to a shortage of supply coming onto the market, and this has led to some people going into a bit of a blind panic. Now, yes, don't get me wrong, there's been certainly a bit of turbulence, but we always knew this was going to happen with the Brexit negotiations starting. But hold on, we knew that Brexit was coming up almost exactly a year ago, and we've building up to this point. So from my travels across Yorkshire and London, I see that the supply and demand balance has just shifted recently. Demand remained very high for properties priced correctly. Supply is slightly down, which means that if you put your home on the market, you've got less competing properties, are likely to get a great response because the demand is so strong, and surely this is good news. So if you're thinking of selling, my advice is to get the top three tips right. Right price, right agent, right presentation. Get these spot on, you really are away. So when you come to buy, you're then in an excellent position and can negotiate from a position of strength. That's what it's about. And I should know, as I've recently done this myself, having bought and sold a property within the last few weeks. Now, if I'm doing this with my years of experience, perhaps the media are stirring up issues to sell newspapers. They wouldn't do that, would they? We're honoured indeed to have property royalty here in the studio and over the phone. This is Alan Waxman from Landmass in London. Just to give people an understanding, Alan is one of London's most high-profile property designers and developers, and actually has been credited with transforming the lower ground floors of much of prime central London, especially in Belgravia and Knightsbridge. And dare I say, you've even been nicknamed the Mole as well, Alan. Great to have you on. On the back of this, how has Landmass come into being? What's your background and why this sort of angle, certainly what you've been known for more recently in terms of the lower ground floor side of things?
Good morning, Alex, and thank you very much for the very kind introduction. I think that when anybody start any career, they never really know how it's going to end up. And the same with my journey through property, because when I started, my only ambition was to buy a few rental properties, starting in Fulham, then Walworth, then Brixton, Clapham, etc., and had nothing to do with actually doing anything about design or indeed building any basements. But what happened was I started, as I said, to build up this portfolio. Then I couldn't get the rental incomes I wanted on one or two of them, so I thought, well, maybe I can sell them for a profit. Managed to do that, having just given them a lick of paint and a clean-up. And then I thought, well, why not buy something in order to redevelop and see if I can do that as well? And I bought a couple of floors above an off-license in Fulham on a very busy road called Wandsworth Bridge Road.
Yeah.
And during the design process, because I wasn't sure how it would sort of pan out, I actually moved the kitchen 3 times, which obviously cost me a lot of money with the builder, but the end result was the flow was good, and I got it checked by a feng shui lady, because I was curious to see what, you know, professionals would think.
Yeah.
And she liked it, and it was the first time that I actually got a higher than expected price from the agents because of what we did.
Right.
And then following on from that, I bought a couple of flats in Notting Hill, which were existing 2-bed flats, and most developers would have perhaps tried to convert them into 3-bed flats, but I really had a big look at the space, and I really thought that once again, how we use a space is so important, and decided to make them into 1-bed flats.
Wow, so you went completely the other direction to most people.
Absolutely, yes. And then Sienna Miller, the actress, bought one of them. Somebody else bought the other. And again, we beat the market expectations because I started to understand that the people really appreciated good space, good planning. And I got a feeling of a thing called emotional purchase, where people, you know, walk in and go, yeah, I like that.
Yeah, and they fall in love with it. And I mean, you're very much renowned for transforming, in particular, lower ground floors and going down, I think, a number of stories going underground. How do you go about transforming what is effectively a windowless lower ground floor dark basement into something that actually sets the property apart and make it excel and obviously get that end result and that end buyer?
Well, the interesting thing about the lower ground is if you just look at the floor plate, what's interesting, you only have the steps going down. You don't have any, obviously, steps going further down because they don't exist. So actually, as against, you know, the other floors, the staircase takes up less room. And so that in turn gives you a much bigger space to work with and also greater opportunity for having the whole space open plan. So that's just talking about the floor plate.
Yeah.
The second thing is crucial for these types of floors is ceiling height. Mm. And we've done anything from 2.75 in my latest project in Notting Hill to 3.4. And interestingly, in Notting Hill, because we'd done the plans some time ago, I didn't realize during the construction phase that the ceiling heights were only 2.5 meters. And so we actually had to go back to planning to get that extra 25 centimeters. And also that meant another party wall award. And it also obviously meant digging down further. And costing more, taking more time, but that extra 25 centimeters per floor actually made a massive difference, and I'm a great believer of turning the negatives to a positive.
Mm.
The next thing, obviously, is how you can introduce natural light. In one project where it was a Muse house and it just had windows at the front, and so everybody who looked at it thought, well, how dark and dingy it was because it had houses on the other 3 sides. But what I did is I took out one of the back corners of the property, put in the glass retractable roof, and then a 10 meter copper waterfall going all the way down.
Wow.
Into a Zen garden. And again, that transformed the negative to a positive. So when people walked in, they were, wow, wasn't expecting to see that. And then amongst the space in the lower ground floor, we also had additional voids. So in essence, double height ceilings to create that special atmosphere. I don't know if that gives you a flavor. And in another property, I put a floor to ceiling copper fireplace in the lower ground floor. So, you know, there's lots of things you can do. So when people go down, they think, wow, I wasn't expecting to see that. And different ways to turn the negative to a positive.
And as you said, just coming in from a completely different angle, and as you said, doing something, I suppose, that's unexpected. And I think that's really what propels your property and your expertise into another level. I think that's a fair comment. And what are people having in these lower ground floors, Alan? What is the space normally, or is it, if you can think of it, you can put it down there, sort of design at all or not?
Obviously, each property is different. And in when I did in Belgravia, where we won best in interior design in the country. We had a bedroom suite which had a steam room on it. We had a TV area. We had the Zen garden, and then we had sort of a laundry and wine cellar. In another one I did in Belgravia, it was just open plan kitchen dining and a bit of a snug with a TV. The one which I've just done in Notting Hill, on the lower ground floor, what I'd done is I dropped the patio garden from ground to lower ground, so you could walk straight out from the kitchen dining snug out onto the terrace. So if you wanted to have al fresco dining, it was easy to sort out. And then the floor below in the basement, we had a TV room. We had two bedrooms, with en suite, both looking out onto the patio. And we had a laundry room.
A huge range of things. And I suppose you're an extremely experienced chap. And I mean, when you look to develop a property, what would you say your top tips in terms of just an insight on that angle?
I think the thing that people forget when they do the numbers on the property is, at the end of the day, the numbers only work if the end product is tip-top. And my company, Landmass, has sort of made a point of making sure that each and every property that we bring to the market, for where it is and what it is, ticks all the boxes. Because if it doesn't, the initial financial appraisal you do, you might as well put it in the bin.
Yeah.
And it's very binary in the higher end of the market, because if people don't like it, they don't then negotiate on the price. They just say, you know, thanks, but not for us. And it's a little bit like in Little Britain, when they go into the travel agent and they want to go away somewhere, and the person behind the desk says, sorry, computer says no. You know, it's as simple as that.
Yeah.
So you've got to get the product right. And on that, it's nothing to do with the finishes. It's all to do with how you create the space. But the three main things, you know, on your appraisal are obviously your sales price, working out what you think you can sell it for.
Yeah.
Secondly, is your construction and professional fees, which will obviously vary from project to project, and to get realistic numbers for that. The contingency is always a red herring, because it's always used up, so you may want to add a little bit on top of that. And then, of course, the timeline, because obviously each project's different, and timeline obviously affects the financials, insofar as the interest costs. Once you've determined those, you then work out what your profit margin wants to be, because, you know, everybody you know has their own formula for that.
Yeah.
And if it's all cash, then that's all straightforward. If you're going to use bank debt, put those numbers in, and then what that in turn does, it then spits out what you can afford to pay for it.
Yeah, quite. So it's a lot more methodical and calculated.
Exactly. So in essence, what you're doing is you're working backwards from the end price, your costs, your timeline, putting your financial costs, putting your margin, and then work out what you can afford to pay for it.
All makes sense on paper, of course, doesn't it? But I guess in the real world, it may be sometimes slightly different. And as you said, you just need to make a very precise judgment call. I think you're very good indeed on the interior design side of things. And I think very often when you're talking about the sort of the light wells and the Zen gardens, it's very much sort of interior design led, and the final sort of touch and the feel of it.
If it's done properly, especially complemented with the same flooring throughout, it does give that feeling of space. Now, it's not as easy as it sounds, because the way we go about it, depending on the property, because each one has different light, we'll look at different shades of white, different times of the day, different rooms in the house, and then different textures of paint. So what we then come up with is something that works best for the property in that location.
What do you feel currently defines luxury in homes at the moment? There's a lot of sort of, say, specialists in inverted commas out there, but what is it? You're at the forefront of it, but what actually defines it? Is it that sort of bespoke touch to everything?
I think the main thing is, if you're doing a property to sell, is as a developer, when I look at my role, it's like being the conductor of the orchestra. And the challenge is putting them, the team, together. And different designers have different egos and different views, and different architects the same. And so the skill of the developer is actually having the vision and then getting the team to follow that vision. And in every case, I've always had disagreements with the design team about what they want to do and what I want to have. And sometimes I've gone along with their ideas, and sometimes they've come along with my ideas. So it's something which you've got to lead from the front, and this really comes from either having the right eye or having the right eye and also experience. But I don't think there's a secret formula. It's just, you know, some people either have it or they don't. And the main thing is that the dog wags the tail, not the tail wags the dog. So you have to, you know, sometimes designers will come up with ideas which, you know, they're super passionate about, but you have to say, well, I don't think that's what the client's going to want or the buyer's going to want.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And,
you know, because in essence, all we're doing is we're creating a widget to sell, you know, and it happens to be a super luxury product. But if people walk in and don't like it, then they'll just walk out the door.
What are the actual rules, I suppose? Do you have any rules, dare I say, in your role, when it actually comes to the interior and the actual finish of a particular project or property that you handle?
Yeah, I mean, Alex, at Landmass, we do follow a very strict process, and that is if we're doing work for a client, obviously step one is to take the brief, understand what they want to achieve out of it. Then the second part is then coming up with design layout solutions, architectural design, which will hopefully give them things which they had never thought about, and looking at a property in a way which they didn't think was.
No, I've got to say, Alan, some fantastic tips and insights into your world. Really fascinating stuff. If anyone wanted to sort of see a bit more, and you briefly mentioned the website, and to get in touch with you, what are the best ways?
Well, as I said, either the easiest way is through the website, which is Landmass, LandMass.co.uk. If they want to email me directly, alan@landmass.co.uk.
Fantastic. I can't thank you enough again, Alan, and really appreciate your time.
The Property Hospital, Stray FM.
The Property Hospital is all about me answering your property concerns and putting you back in control. Now, this week I'm answering a question from Tom, who's got this question to ask.
Hi, Alex. I'm about to put my house onto the market. I've seen 3 agents, but I don't know which one to appoint. Do you have any insider tips, please?
Tom, useful question and one often asked by many homeowners. The points that regularly come up revolve around price, fees or professionalism. Now, most vendors think they're doing the logical thing by choosing a mixture of these points. However, they're all completely wrong. What you need to look at is each agent's front of house team. These are the people sat in the estate agent's office each day, meeting and greeting, walk-in inquiries, taking incoming phone calls, and they are the ones that actually know the buyer database. These are the people who will actually sell your home and not the estate agent sat in your kitchen. Now, if you want to check out the front of house team, before you see the agents at your home, go into each estate agent's office and see how knowledgeable and helpful the front of house team were. Mystery shop them, in effect. You will know instantly which agent to go with. If you're treated well as a prospective purchaser, then you're more likely likely to find the right answer when you come to sell.
The Property Hot Seat. Stray
FM. Name.
Joel Smith.
Business.
S&SA Architects.
Time in property.
I've been operating as an architect in Harrogate and London for the last 10 years.
We are honoured indeed to have Joel Smith here in the studio today just to talk through architects, both on the residential side and indeed the commercial side, and just to sort of, I suppose, demystify what these guys actually do. Now, Joel, it's a big hot topic at the moment. You've very much got grand designs, dare I say, small spaces and good old George Clark in there, and they're making extending and building look mighty easy. How do you rate these programmes? Do they have a point at all?
Yes, Alex. The simple answer is I do rate these programmes, and actually I think they're really valid. One, they're enjoyable and informative, but two, I think they help elevate the role of the designer and how we can affect the spaces that we live in. I think the consideration for any extension, for instance, should always be, how can I improve the space that I dwell in? And certainly Kevin MacLeod has championed that to such a high degree that he's really helped the industry. I'm not 100% sure that they make the process look easy, though. In fact, in many cases, they focus on the pitfalls, the challenges, and in a sense, they have to, of course, increase the drama, which often leaves me voicing my opinion, should we say, at the TV. But as I say, Kevin MacLeod specifically has done an incredible amount to raise an awareness.
It's helped you in terms of an architect's practice, because people are saying, well, I've seen this off TV, I've got this sort of idea that I want to do to my home, and can we involve you? And it's working more along those lines.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I say, they do champion the role of architect within that. And yeah, certainly once you see people who've seen and got a little bit of ambition and a little bit of, you know, desire to improve their space, that helps no end. And from an architect's point of view, it's great to see what contemporaries are up to.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, these programmes often talk about the phrase or the term permitted development. And a lot of people think, well, again, I think this may be sort of more serialised on television, but permitted development makes it sound very easy to get that grand extension and off you go. That's what these programmes tend to suggest. How does that actually work in real life terms, so to speak? What is permitted development? How does it
right, yeah,
work?
No, fair question, Alex, and you're right, it's certainly a hot topic, and it's a great thing, actually. A permitted development rights essentially are a national grant of planning permission. They allow buildings to work to be carried out without having to make an application for planning. However, you still need to be aware of certain aspects. You still, of course, need to notify your local authority and, as always, ensure building regulations compliance. Permitted development is, in principle, as I say, a great idea, and I believe that it has the intention of aiding a really important aspect of our economy, you know, the smaller builders, the tradesmen, the designers, and, you know, we in the UK have a very interesting approach to our homes. You know, I find this really interesting. We have the smallest space standards in Europe, yet our homes are our castle. It turns out they're not the biggest by comparison, but what do I want to say? But yeah, as I say, you still need to contact the local authority and make them aware of your intentions. Permitted development rights are quite prescriptive, so I would urge anybody considering permitted development or any extension to look at the planning portal, speak with your local authority if you need to. Obviously, as I would always say, speak with the designer. They have to be aware of things like designated areas, where specifically in the Harrogate area, for instance, conservation areas, areas of outstanding natural beauty. In some instances, if you've extended before, you may need to, you know, speak to your local authority before. There's things to be aware of. And as I say, you do need to do a little bit of research here, Alex, because you've got existing curtilage of your site, principal elevations to your property. What's the size of the proposed extension? What's the height? How close are you to your boundary?
So good old George Clark, it's not quite as straightforward as going, oh, we're going to put on this lovely little extension and let's just build it tomorrow afternoon. There is a bit more of a process. It's not as simple as possibly they make out.
Well, I can't comment on George Clark because he's a fellow contemporary, of course. But, you know, you always need to take some appropriate advice. I would always ensure that.
OK, and in terms of, I suppose, the larger extensions, just going, I suppose, beyond the permitted development, and again, this is from the private individual's perspective, what do you actually need to be mindful of when you want to take such a project? I'm thinking sort of the time frames and what's actually involved in the planning process there.
Yeah, fair enough. And I can appreciate in a lot of instances for people looking to extend, it can come across as provisionally quite daunting. And actually, there's a few things to consider before you even take pen to paper, as it were. I'd personally always refer people to the RIBA website. They do a great bit of work for the profession in the background and the forefront, in fact. You know, they do many useful sections, progressive design areas, but also help you find the architect who can start the ball rolling with you. From a personal point of view, there's a good local subgroup in this area called the North Yorkshire Society of Architects. Again, they work to promote good design and architects and the role we can play. But enough of the professional pitch. Back to your question. The first consideration should surely be, what are we extending for? What are my needs?
Yeah.
In the practice, we would call this determining the brief. What does the design need to reflect in terms of your requirement as the owner and the client? In terms of time frames, there's actually many factors to take into account. And, you know, the REBA, again, have a great useful guide called the Plan of Work, which identifies key stages to be mindful of. So okay. I refer back to identification of need. What do you want to gain out of our project? Preliminary design, you know, how as we start to get things on paper, how does it look? Does it reflect what we've got in our minds? Are we getting it on paper? And of course, we need to amend that design to reflect those needs and ultimately finalise these proposals. Of course, then you have to go for your planning permission and planning consent, you know, with can take between 8 and 12 weeks, but bear in mind it can take longer.
When and why would it take longer? Because of the size or complexity of the job, or if the council fall behind?
All of those factors come into it. Yeah, but also, you know, is there a challenge with the design? Is there some, you know, is there additional legislation you need to be aware of? So again, dialogue at that point is important, and you have to be a slightly open-minded to that, I think, from my point of view. Time to discharge any pre-commencement conditions. When you've got that piece of paper from the planners, you know, hopefully it's the piece of paper you want. It says granted.
Yeah.
But of course, there's often pre-commencement conditions there, which again just looks to protect you ultimately, but also ensure that it fits with the planning permission granted.
Okay.
So that can take a little bit of time, but then of course you need to cost the project, obtain suitable quotes, and time to actually construct the extension. And I think also just in the background, not necessarily a time frame question, Alec, but you know, how are you going to have that built and who's going to build it for you? I'd always suggest requesting referrals. Referrals are a great bit of use.
Yeah, sort of recommended builders.
Recommended, yeah. I mean, British people like to refer. You know, if someone's not referring somebody, what's the reason behind that? We all like a referral, you know. And so, yeah.
So it makes life easier.
I think so. And have a look at the work they've done, maybe. You know, surely they should be proud of the work they've undertaken, the designs they've come up with, and that should be a constructive dialogue. Certainly do that, please.
And how do you, I know people are often, I suppose, mindful. How do you actually keep the local authority? How do you keep, for example, here, Harrogate Borough Council on side? Because you do hear, albeit, I dare say, sort of serialised in the media, that people have run into all sorts of difficulties with their planning application. Why have they gone amiss? And why have they got on the wrong side of the council? How do you keep them in their good books?
Dialogue, simple as that. In simple terms, I personally would never recommend approaching an application with conflict on the agenda. You know, do things properly. The role of the architect here is to interpret your needs, provide information and help you navigate the planning process. And as I say, the LA shouldn't be viewed with a barrier. It's not there to be bashed down. You need to approach any development with an open mind and be prepared to discuss your proposals with them. This, as you've touched on, they do get a bit of negative press, but that's because maybe they're viewed on an isolated basis, case-by-case basis.
Yeah.
Their position, in fairness, is to protect the areas in which we live. So the areas that will exist much longer than we will, and really they're part of a wider policy to make sure that amenity space and positive design and construction, you know, reflects where we live.
So if you know their rules and you're ticking their boxes, away you go, you're not going to have an issue. It's if you want to do something, I say, that's sort of pushing the boundaries or possibly being slightly controversial, that's when, as you said, in an isolated case, it may not be looked upon possibly favourably.
Yeah, it's a difficult one to answer that, Alex, because, you know, the local authority is there to champion good design as well. You know, the positive design from their point of view.
Fair comment.
So they want to progress that with you. And really, you know, that maybe areas of conservation might need a slightly different approach, etc. But yeah, I think in the main, the idea is, you know, better design helps everyone ultimately.
Yeah.
And I think they're on board with that. I sort of don't see any negativity when it comes to positive design.
Fantastic. Joel, I can't thank you enough. Very useful and great insight there. So if anyone needs to discuss any of their home getting extended, the permitted development, the small space type of thing, or the commercial side of things, what's the best way for people to reach you?
Oh, fabulous. Well, I'd be more than happy to speak to anybody who's got any queries. My number is 01423 856 999. But you're more than welcome to look at our website, which is www.ssaarchitects.co.uk.
Fantastic, Joel. Thank you very much again. Really appreciate your time.
Alex Goldstein's top tip.
Well, I've got some unusual top tips for you this month because this is my last ever show with Stray FM and I've had an absolute blast over the last 15 months and thoroughly enjoyed putting the show together. The feedback from listeners and people downloading the podcast has been fabulous, with my social media accounts rife with activity as a result. Many people are saying how much they've learned about property through listening to the show, and that's exactly why I did it. Exciting developments are on the horizon, so look out for my new expert videos and live Q&A sessions. These can be found on the new website, alexgoldstein.co.uk. So, listen in. My top tips for this month are: follow me on Twitter at alexogoldstein. Number two, find me on LinkedIn and Facebook at Alex Goldstein Property Consultants. Of course, visit the website alexgoldstein.co.uk regularly for the latest hot property tips, news and videos. And my last top tip, enjoy your property move, and thank you as ever for listening. That's all from the Alex Goldstein Property Show.